even if she had a good life of her own. You should get a boyfriend, Mom. That would be fun for you. You're still great-looking. Frank thinks you're hot, she said sincerely, and Kate laughed. Tell him thank you for the compliment. And where do you suggest I find one? Place a personal ad? Send out a mailer? Pick up guys in bars? Kate was teasing her. Life seemed so simple at Stephanie's age, and she lived on her own planet, where other people's lives weren't real to her. She had always been that way, and now Frank had joined her in their limited universe, where they related better to computers than people. "You must meet a lot of cool guys," Stephanie continued. "Not really, and I'm actually happy like this. I'm busy with the magazine, my blog, Twitter, Facebook, and the rest. I'm happy to come home and collapse at night. And when I read the letters I get, I'm relieved I don't have the problems that go with most relationships. I've been married twice. I don't want the headache of someone screwing up my life, arguing with me, maybe cheating on me, wanting to change the way I live, telling me what to do and how to do it, and being angry about my career and how much I work, or hating my friends. People put up with a lot to make relationships work. I don't want to do that again. I kind of have it all the way I want it, except for you guys being spread all over the map in 3 cities, on 2 continents. But I'm used to that, too, now. She looked content as she said it. I miss all of you, but I'm fine on my own. You're not old enough to give up on romance. Carmen had said the same thing, but Kate hadn't been in love in years, and it hadn't gone well when she was. Her life was comfortable just the way she had it. You don't need to get married again. Just have a guy you can go out with when you feel like it. That sounds more like an escort service than love, her mother teased her. I don't think men like being on call. They expect more than that, and they should. I think the whole era of social media has given people the impression that you can use an app to conjure up a guy whenever you want, and then dismiss him like an Uber car when you're tired of him. And I know there are people who do that, but that's not me. There's no substance to that. I can't see the point of it. I like the old values and relationships. I just don't know if I want one for me. And when I think about it seriously, I realize I don't. That's too bad, Mom. You're too nice and too much fun and too smart to sit here by yourself. I think you should start dating. She made it sound like a sport Kate should take up again, like tennis or golf. But Kate knew it was a lot more work than that. After her last marriage and her totally misjudging Adrian and being taken in by him, she had no desire to try again. And she hadn't met a man in several years who caught her fancy anyway. It was an easy sacrifice to make. "Thanks for the suggestion," Kate said, and hugged her again as Stephanie glanced at her watch. "I'd better get to bed early. I have to leave the house at 5 a.m. tomorrow to catch my flight. Don't bother getting up to say goodbye. We can say it tonight." But Kate immediately shook her head. "There's no way I'm going to let you leave without giving you a hug and saying goodbye. What else do I have to do? I can go back to bed after you leave." She never let her children leave without seeing them off. She never had, and wasn't about to start now. "You don't have to," Stephanie said generously. "I know I don't. I'd feel cheated if I didn't get a last hug in before you go," she said, smiling at her, and Stephanie laughed. "You're still a mom," she said, looking as though the concept was a mystery to her, and Kate suspected that was the case. Maternal instincts did not appear to be part of her daughter's makeup, although she was sweet to her brother's kids and acted like a child herself with them. "Of course I'm a mom," Kate smiled at her. "That's forever. It's part of who I am, no matter how old you get." It was particularly meaningful to her, since her own mother had abandoned her as a baby. Years later, her grandmother had made a concerted effort to discover what had happened to Kate's mother, thinking Kate had a right to know, and had learned that she had drowned in a boating accident in Spain when Kate was about 10 years old. But her mother had never attempted to contact her or see her after she left, in the 9 years before her death. Motherhood hadn't been part of her skills either, and she'd made no attempt to grow into it. Kate's grandmother was the only mother she'd ever had, which was part of what drove Kate to be so dedicated to her kids. She never wanted to be even remotely like her own mother. "Well, my feelings won't be hurt if you don't get up," Stephanie assured her, but she knew Kate would. Kate set her alarm for 4:30 when she went to bed, back in her own bedroom. The next morning she knocked on Stephanie's door with a cup of coffee and a piece of toast, and set them down next to Stephanie's bed. 20 minutes later, Stephanie emerged, in Frank's plaid jacket with her carry-on, looking fresh-faced, with her dark hair still damp from the shower. She'd had a good Christmas with her mother, but she was excited to be joining Frank in a few hours. He was her real life now. Her mother was a piece of history, an important landmark, and an anchor for her, a touchstone she could come back to whenever she wanted. The two women hugged for a long moment, and Kate kissed her and took a last long look at her as they waited for the elevator. Then, with a broad smile and a wave, Stephanie thanked her mother for a wonderful Christmas, and she was gone when the elevator door closed. Kate stood staring at it for a long moment, and walked slowly back into her apartment. She felt lost for a minute, looking around, as though recognizing her own life again, the life where she was an adult woman alone, and her children were gone. And no matter how she filled it, denied it, or tried to ignore it, she was what her readers talked about with such poignancy. She was an empty nester. And after Stephanie left, in the silence of the apartment, Kate walked back into her bedroom, got into her bed, and cried, missing them fiercely. Chapter 3 The week between Christmas and New Year's was bitter cold, and it snowed twice. Stephanie texted Kate from Montana to say she had arrived safely, and Tommy sent a text from the Bahamas to thank her for a nice time and their gifts. After the initial shock of their departure, after the time they'd spent together, which always hit her when they first left, Kate got back into the groove of her own life. In some ways, it was pleasant being the parent of adult children. She could do whatever she wanted. Work, relax, sleep, read, watch TV, see friends, or do nothing at all. She could eat at any hour and not worry about entertaining anyone, or making sure they were having a good time. There was always a balance, and sometimes a conflict, between wanting to spend time with her children, missing them when they were gone, and liking time to herself. It was a luxury she had never had as a single parent when they were growing up. She was always doing something for them then, or worrying about them, helping with homework, keeping an eye on who their friends were, consoling their broken hearts, helping them fill out college applications, or talking to them about the important things in life. And at the same time, juggling her professional obligations and doing her work and meeting deadlines. She had often thought of her grandmother during those times, who had gone from opulence and grandeur, with unlimited money and no responsibilities, to a one-bedroom walk-up apartment, taking care of 4 children herself without the help of maids, governesses, or nannies, and starting a business making cookies and cakes for neighborhood restaurants, so her own children could eat and have a roof over their heads and new shoes. And on the days when the obstacles ahead seemed insurmountable, Kate remembered what her grandmother had accomplished, and knew that she could do it too, in much easier circumstances than her grandmother had wrestled with at a far more difficult time. Kate did her work for her column, did a Q&A interview for the Los Angeles Times by email on her new computer, and, as a reward to herself, watched another episode of her favorite series again. It was always enjoyable for her, no matter how many times she'd watched it. The situations in Downton Abbey usually resolved satisfactorily after an episode or two. You knew who the good people were and the bad guys, and what to expect of them. She was surprised by how much comfort it gave her. Carmen had a whole other list of favorite shows that she liked for different reasons, and they talked about over lunch. She preferred mysteries and wasn't bothered by violence, and shows that had a science fiction quality to them were the ones that she loved best, which Kate didn't like at all. Everyone seemed to have a favorite show these days, on the cable channels or by streaming. The era of sophisticated series on television had come into its own. 4 days after Stephanie left, Kate got a call from the friends who invited her to their New Year's Eve party every year. It was always something of a haphazard gathering of people who had nothing else to do and didn't want to spend the night at home. She had already decided not to go this year. She didn't want to venture out into the cold and battle for a cab to get there, and it was supposed to snow again. It seemed like a perfect time to stay home, and she had declined their invitation 2 weeks before. She didn't have a date, and didn't want to spend another New Year's Eve watching other people kiss at midnight, while she pretended not to care. Normally, she didn't, but on special nights like that, she hated feeling like a loser or the odd man out. New Year's Eve seemed designed for that. Kate was surprised when Jessica Hartley called her herself to convince her to join them. She worked in the art department at a rival magazine and was a talented artist. Her husband ran a hedge fund on Wall Street. They weren't close friends, but the Hartleys invited her to their New Year's Eve party every year, and she had gone many times. "Come on, Kate. It's a tradition. You can't skip it this year." But that was precisely what she wanted to do. A night in bed in her pajamas watching television and eating takeout sounded more appealing than getting dressed up and risking life and limb on icy streets and bad weather. But Jessica was persuasive, and Kate was annoyed at herself when she ran out of excuses to decline and finally accepted. She was even more so when it took nearly an hour for a car to come to pick her up while she waited in the lobby, wishing she hadn't accepted. The car finally arrived and took her downtown to the Hartleys' West Village apartment. Like her, they had grown children. Both of theirs were in college, and Jessica had said they were home for Christmas break and had plans of their own that night. She complained that they hardly saw them while they were in town. They were always out with friends. Jessica and Sam were delighted to see Kate when she got there, and welcomed her warmly. There was a group of people standing around the fireplace, trying to get warm, and as they did every year, the women were wearing long gowns or dressy cocktail dresses, and the men had worn black tie. It was the one night of the year when all the Hartleys' friends agreed to dress up. Kate had worn an old black velvet skirt with a white satin blouse, and she tried to get into the mood as she accepted a glass of champagne from Sam and stood near the fireplace with the others. It was the coldest night so far that winter, breaking some kind of record for miserable weather, which made Kate long for her bed again. Although she only saw them once a year, she recognized nearly everyone there that night. But there was one unfamiliar face in the crowd. His name was Zach Winter, and Sam said they had been college roommates. He was a TV producer from L.A., Jessica whispered, and she told Kate that he produced several award-winning series, and coincidentally was single, and had just gotten divorced. She realized then why they had insisted that she join them, since she was the only single woman in the room, and she was being offered as some kind of blind date for the night, which made the evening seem even more arduous before it began. He was wearing a dinner jacket with a black T-shirt, jeans, and black suede loafers, and he was very L.A. The only thing missing, Kate thought to herself, was a gold chain around his neck. And he looked like he hadn't shaved in a week, which made him appear more unkempt than trendy at his age. Kate didn't bother trying to make conversation with him, since she had noticed on the seating chart that they would be next to each other at dinner. She wasn't looking forward to it, no matter how successful his shows were. She would have been more impressed if he had worn a pressed white shirt, the bottom half of his suit, and shaved. He was about the same age as Kate. But by the time they sat down to dinner an hour later, everyone had relaxed. The food they served was always delicious, and people were anticipating a good dinner and a pleasant evening with a congenial group of people. "I used to read your column. I'm an avid Tell Kate fan," Zach told her pleasantly after they sat down. "I tried to save my marriage with it, but I think my ex-wife was a little beyond your scope. We're having a custody battle over the dog. I still read your blog and follow you on Twitter," he said, as a waiter from the Hartleys' caterer set down cold crab in front of them, and Kate wasn't sure if she should be sympathetic or laugh. But he seemed good-humored, and she decided to be honest with him, no matter how unkempt he looked. He was like a stereotype of an L.A. producer, or what she imagined one would look like. He asked her what her favorite shows were, and she admitted to being a Downton Abbey addict, and he smiled. "Whenever I have a bad day, I watch two of my favorite episodes, from the last two seasons, and the world feels like a better place again," he said. The woman on his other side overheard them, asked which show it was, and admitted to being hooked, too, and then went into rhapsodies about one of his shows, a modern-day family saga set in Australia, and Zack seemed pleased. And the man seated across from them started talking about the police drama he had been devoted to for the last 3 years. Within 5 minutes, half the table was talking about which series they liked best, and Kate listened to them, amused, as Zack leaned toward her and laughed, too. "It's a national frenzy," he said to her. "You just hope you come up with the right show at the right time. There's always an element of luck involved in a big show." He was modest about his success, and an avalanche of comments and heated discussions had started at the table about their favorite shows, several of which were Zack's. Kate had seen two of them, but didn't watch them regularly. "We have 3 hit shows on the air at the moment, and we're starting a new one in January about a Chinese family in Hong Kong. I'm not sure it's your cup of tea, though. It's edgier than the others, with a fair amount of violence in it," he said to Kate. "You're right. That's not my thing," she agreed. "I love my nice, cozy family show. I've watched a couple of other series, and they always stress me out more than when I started watching. I enjoyed seeing 2 of yours, though." He laughed. "Some people like violence and high stress. It's like shock therapy. It distracts them from real life." "Real life is distracting and shocking enough. I don't need more on TV." They chatted more about his next show, and what shooting on location in China was like, which he said had been difficult. He was knowledgeable about his subject and well-traveled. She found him personable and intelligent to talk to, despite his somewhat shaggy appearance, which would have gone over better in L.A. than at the Hartleys' New Year's Eve party. There was nothing trendy or avant-garde about them, and Zack stuck out like a sore thumb, but he was so likable that no one cared. And for most of the guests, his success balanced out his trendy L.A. look. And after a while, Kate forgot about it, too. They talked about their kids then, their jobs, L.A. versus New York. He had grown up in New York and started out producing Broadway shows, and had gone to London to work in TV and then L.A., and had done well at it. He was one of the most important producers in television, but he seemed quiet and unassuming. And Sam startled her over dessert when he spoke directly to Kate, loud enough for Zack to hear him. "You should write a TV show, Kate. You could base it on your family." "Any drug lords in your family or famous criminals?" Zack teased her, and she laughed and shook her head. "Hardly. I think Sam is referring to my grandmother, who was a remarkable woman. The family lost everything in the crash of 29, and my grandfather committed suicide. She moved to a walk-up apartment on the Lower East Side with 4 children, under 5, and no money, and she had never worked in her life. She started baking cookies, and then cakes, and sold them to restaurants, and kept them all alive, and provided for them. Fast forward the film, and she sold the business to General Foods years later. Mrs. Whittier's Cakes, and the cookies were abbreviated to 4 Kids. You've probably eaten them." "Are you kidding? They were the mainstay of my diet all through my childhood, and still are. That was your grandmother?" He looked vastly impressed. "She must have been quite a woman," he said admiringly, and was suddenly even more interested in Kate. He had enjoyed talking to her all through dinner, and liked her looks and understated elegance. "She was," Kate said. "I grew up with her. But that's another story. My mother disappeared when I was a year old, and my father died a year later, so I grew up with my grandmother. We had a great time together, and she taught me all I know about life. I smelled a strong matriarch there somewhere when I read your column. I never made the connection, though, between Kate Whittier and Mrs. Whittier's Cakes. She must have made a fortune when she sold it." And then he looked suddenly embarrassed. "I'm sorry. That was rude. But I love stories like that, of people who take life by the throat and refuse to be defeated, especially women, and in those days, That was a major accomplishment. She believed that you can do anything you want to, or have to do. She was the bravest woman I've ever known. I always tell myself I'll write a book about her, but I haven't yet. What about a Bible for a TV show instead? He threw it out as a random idea off the top of his head, referring to the synopsis used to tell the basic story of a TV show. She knew what he meant. Not necessarily about her cookies and cakes, but a woman like her, who has lost everything and doesn't just survive, but creates a whole new life. Stories like that inspire people. It's why you love the show you watch. People need role models and inspiration. And it's even more impressive when you think she did it in the early 30s, when women like her didn't even have jobs or know how to work. There were a few women scientists then, and in the arts, but no businesswomen, especially from what I have to assume was a very elitist world. Weren't the Whittiers related to the Vanderbilts and the Astors? Cousins, she confirmed. I'm not sure they spoke to my grandmother once she started baking. Commerce was very poorly viewed then, and wasn't considered an option for women, or even for most men in her world. That's what I mean, and what I love about it, Zack said, his eyes alight with interest, and Kate smiled, thinking of her grandmother. She had been a small, elegant, dignified, erect woman who was every bit a grande dame for most of her life, and wore beautiful hats when she went to her office. She stopped doing the baking herself after the first few years, although she created the recipes or found them in old European cookbooks. It was 5 minutes to midnight by then, and the time had flown, talking to each other. Sam began the countdown as they left the table and wandered back to the living room. "Happy New Year!" Sam shouted, and pulled his wife into his arms to give her a kiss to start the new year. The other guests did the same with their partners, and Zack looked at Kate sympathetically. It was an awkward position for them to be in, chatting with a stranger at midnight on New Year's Eve, while everyone else embraced. "I'd kiss you, but you might slap me," he said playfully. And he didn't look as though he wanted to, but he had enjoyed talking to her. "Happy New Year, Kate," he said softly. "I hope you have someone more exciting to spend it with next year," he said ruefully, and she laughed. This was exciting enough. "Happy New Year, Zack," she said as he took out his wallet, extracted a business card, and handed it to her. "I know this is incredibly rude at a dinner party, but if you ever decide to write something for dramatic purposes about your grandmother or a woman like her, give me a call. We can always use stories like that." He sounded as though he meant it, and she slipped his card into her bag. "I don't think I could write a screenplay. At least I never have. It's not something I'm familiar with." "You don't have to. All you have to write is the Bible. The producer would find a screenwriter for you, and you could work together. You just have to write the overview and some ideas for 13 episodes if you sell it to a major network, and anywhere from 6 to 20 on cable. They make their own rules. And then pray they come back for more. I hope you do write something, Kate. You know enough about people and women from the column you write to come up with some great ideas and storylines. I love what you have to say, because it's sensible and smart, real and direct. There's nothing phony about it. You write things anyone can relate to, even a man. I learned some things about women reading your column." She could tell that he was serious, and she was touched. "So, have you two come up with a hit TV series?" Sam asked, when he walked up to them. He had noticed that they had talked animatedly all through dinner, and he wondered if Zack was going to ask her out. Sam knew Kate wasn't his usual profile. Zack liked younger women, mostly actresses, and sometimes the stars in his shows. But Kate was beautiful and intelligent, and would have made more sense than the starlets he normally went out with. But Sam couldn't tell if there was chemistry between them or not. Kate was too polite to show it, and Zack kept his game to himself and always had, even in college. He was one of the few guys Sam knew who didn't brag about his conquests. He could have, but it wasn't his style. "We're working on it," was all Zack said to his former roommate, as Kate drifted away to talk to her hostess and other guests. "Interesting woman. Fascinating background." Zack commented, and then wandered away himself. Zack came to say goodnight to Kate just before he left. He was flying back to L.A. the next day on an early flight. He reminded Kate to call him if she had any ideas, but she doubted she would. She couldn't imagine what she could think of for a Bible for a TV show. And as she had said to Zack, she wanted to save her grandmother's story to write her biography one day. She would be an inspiration even to modern women, and had been decades ahead of her time, by sheer necessity, if nothing else. Kate left a little while later, and was glad she had come. She had enjoyed meeting Zack and talking to him. She was sure they would never meet again. There was no crossover between their worlds. But it was fun to meet new and different people, and suddenly his Hollywood aura was of no importance. Clearly he had talent, or a good eye for what worked, with so many successes on TV. His many victories were proof of that. "What did you think of Zack?" Jessica asked her once Kate had her coat on and was about to leave. She looked at Kate meaningfully, who ignored the innuendo and answered her sincerely. "He's terrific to talk to, and was a great dinner partner. Thank you for seating him next to me," she said politely, but meant it. "That's it? You didn't find him fatally sexy?" "I'm sure I'm not his type," she said simply, and he wasn't hers either. He was pure L.A., part of the entertainment world, and could have any star he wanted at his feet, Kate was sure. And he seemed like the kind of man who'd prefer very young, sexy women, since he had easy access to them. "Well, I'm glad you liked him," Jessica said as the other guests began to leave and Kate slipped out. She could see there was a long wait for an Uber, so she asked the doorman to get her a cab. She stood outside for a few minutes, waiting for him to return with one, and by the time he got back 5 minutes later, her face, ears, and hands were numb. She slid in gratefully and gave the driver her address uptown. He was relieved to find her sober and almost hadn't stopped for her on his way back to the garage. New Year's Eve was a hard night to drive. "Happy New Year," the driver said in a heavy Indian accent. He was wearing a bright turquoise turban, and Kate smiled when she saw it. It had been a nice evening, much more so than she had expected, thanks to Zack. And she was flattered that he thought she should write a Bible for a show. And it pleased her that he liked her blog and followed her on Twitter. She put a lot of time and thought into what she wrote. She loved helping people, but had no instant inspiration for a TV series. She didn't think she had anything more in her than tell Kate. She didn't want to do anything more exotic than that, even if she enjoyed what she watched on TV herself. And as the perfect end to the evening, she put on a DVD from the last season of Downton Abbey and watched the final Christmas special on her laptop when she got home. She knew she'd be up late if she did, but she could sleep in the next morning. And she was going back to the magazine the day after. Her Christmas break was over. It had been a nice one, and she'd caught up on her work. She was starting the new year fresh, with a clean slate. It was a good feeling. And as the theme music of the show came on, she sank back onto the mountain of pillows on her bed and settled in to enjoy it. Despite her reservations, it had been a very nice New Year's Eve after all, and she was glad she'd gone. The episode she'd chosen of Downton Abbey was one of her favorites, and before it was over, she had fallen fast asleep as the new year began. Chapter 4 When Kate woke up on New Year's morning, the DVD had finished, her laptop battery had run out, and the lights were on. She got up to plug her computer into the charger, looked out her window, and saw that it was snowing heavily outside, and almost everything had come to a standstill. A few buses were running, and there were one or two cabs moving slowly. The snow was deep. She went to make herself a cup of coffee, and sat down at the new computer that had been a gift from Stephanie. She still wasn't totally at ease with it. It had more options and fancy frills than her old one, but she loved it. She wondered what to do for the rest of the day. She was caught up on the letters she had to answer for the column, her tweets and her blog, and she didn't want to go out in heavy weather. She thought of Tommy and his family in the Bahamas, and Stephanie in Montana with Frank. She wondered where Candace was and what she was doing, and she sat staring at the blank screen for a while and suddenly had an idea. It was just a sliver of a thought in her mind, but she had a sudden urge to play with it and see where it went. She had nothing else to do that day. The story begins in 1940, before America has entered World War II. Lachlan Wilder is roughly 40 years old and has a fascination with old planes and collects them. He can fly anything with wings and has spent every penny he can lay hands on to build his collection. He is passionate about flying and anything to do with aviation. He is a mechanic and a pilot, has restored many planes, and his wife, Anne, is supportive of him, although all the money he could find has gone into his planes. He inherited some money and made some, and spent it all on his collection. Their house is mortgaged to the hilt. Only Anne understands how much flying means to him. They have four children in their teens. Two of them have caught the flying bug from him. He's a handsome, sexy, wild man, and Anne is deeply in love with him. He has taught Anne to fly, too, and she's a good pilot, although she doesn't love it as he does. Anne frequently defends him to her stern mother, Hannibal, who thinks him an irresponsible fool and says so every chance she gets. She doesn't understand him and doesn't want to. Their oldest son, Bill, is 18. His father taught him to fly and to work on the engines. Bill is solid, serious, and has his pilot's license. But it is Maggie, their second child, who shares her father's skill for flying and love of old airplanes. She is 17 and doesn't have her license yet, but he has taken her up with him, and she can fly everything they've got. She has her father's gift and wishes she could be a pilot one day. He has taught her to do aerobatics, and she's something of a daredevil. She has more guts than her brother in the cockpit. Bill is steady and sure. Maggie is more fiery than her brothers and more like her father. Anne and Locke have two younger children. Greg has no interest in flying and is constantly up to mischief in some form at 15. He has big dreams, none of which include planes. And their youngest child is Crystal, a striking beauty who is boy-crazy at 14 and also could care less about planes. Kate was writing furiously as the story unfolded in her head. As the war worsens in Europe, shortly after the story begins, Locke tells Anne that he wants to go to England and volunteer to fly with the Royal Air Force. They are taking American volunteers, and he knows a few other pilots who have gone. He has already made the decision and sold two of his planes to leave Anne enough money to manage without him. He feels compelled to go, and Anne knows him too well to try and stop him. Anne agrees to let him go out of love and respect for him. They tell the kids. Bill and Maggie think he's a hero. Hannibal is horrified at how he can leave his wife and family. Locke leaves for England. Anne is left to manage without him and deal with her kids. She is a strong, quiet woman who believes in her husband, although she is afraid for him. There is a touching scene between them before he leaves, and a flood of criticism from Anne's mother once he's gone. Locke has left them enough money to get by, although it will be tight. Anne considers getting a job for extra money, and then has an idea. They're going to put Locke's planes to good use. They can fly people short distances, like a flying taxi service. Both she and Bill are capable of it. They can also give flying lessons. Bill is determined to help his mother. She calls their business Wilder Aircraft, and they put up a sign offering to charter their planes and give lessons. Maggie wants to help too, but doesn't have her license yet. Hannibal, Anne's mother, is constantly furious at Locke running off to England and leaving his family, and she thinks Anne's plan to make some extra money is a crazy idea. She says Anne should sell all Locke's planes while he's gone to give them more money to live on, and it would serve him right for going off and leaving them. Bill tries to help his mother control his younger brother, which 15-year-old Greg resents. He is constantly in some form of minor trouble or other, especially in school. And Crystal is equally hard to manage, always sneaking off to go out with some boy. Bill tries to help, but the younger two are difficult. And at 17, all Maggie cares about are planes. She can't wait to get her license. The business takes off slowly, but starts to work. A few people sign up for lessons. Some local businessmen charter their planes to get to meetings in other towns. And Anne manages the business well, probably better than her husband would have. She's far more practical than Locke. They're making enough money to add to what Locke left them, and it helps Anne provide for them. But when there are no lessons or charters, things are still tight. Her mother tells her again to sell some or all of Locke's planes, but she won't out of respect for him. It would break his heart. Hannibal doesn't care, and thinks he deserves it for running off. Some of the planes are very special and rare, and Maggie can fly them all. She goes up with her brother as she used to with her father. She lives to fly, just as her father does. While Locke is flying for the British in the RAF, Anne is handling everything at home efficiently and bravely. Her little business gets solid over the next year and does well. And then Pearl Harbor hits. The first peacetime draft in history had begun a year before, in September 1940, but Bill had not been drafted. After Pearl Harbor, Locke comes home from England to enlist with the American Flying Forces. Locke spends some time with each of his children before he has to leave again, and he urges younger son Greg to behave. There is a tender parting with Anne again, and he is proud of how she has run the business and saved his planes. Maggie is 18 now and gets her pilot's license. Bill is drafted, and Maggie helps her mother give lessons and fly charters. Both Locke and Bill leave for war. Bill goes to flight training in the military. Anne and Maggie run the business, while Greg and Crystal continue to misbehave, with no male figure now to help control them. Crystal looks older than her 15 years and is trouble. Men are drawn to her like moths to flame, and she encourages them shamelessly, and Anne tries to stop her with no success. As she wrote the words, Kate remembered learning about the wasps in the past, and looked them up on the Internet, and was excited about what she found. She read avidly, fascinated by the history of a courageous group of women who had received little acknowledgment for their heroic acts in World War II. The Women Air Force Service Pilots Program was created in 1942, after Pearl Harbor, to enlist the help of female civilian pilots. After training in Texas, they towed drones and targets with live ammunition for gunnery practice, tested and repaired aircraft, served as instructors, transported cargo to embarkation points, and ferried and delivered planes to other locations. They often flew at night and were non-combat pilots, but flew dangerous missions. They remained civilians and were used for purposes that would free up male military pilots for combat. They flew every type of aircraft, from PT-17 and AT-6 trainers, the fastest attack planes like the A-24 and A-26, and medium and heavy bombers, which were B-25s and B-17s. They were never officially part of the military, received no benefits or honors, flew when they were called upon to do so, and were paid $250 a month. Once the WASP program was established, 25,000 female pilots applied to help the war effort, and 1,830 were accepted. Other than their flying credentials, they had to be 21 years of age or older, and 5 feet and 1/2 inch tall. They flew their missions heroically. 38 WASP pilots were killed in the course of their assignments, and in December 1944, after nearly 3 years of flying, the WASPs were no longer needed, and the program was disbanded. The records of their missions were sealed for more than 30 years. In 1977, Congress voted to make the surviving WASPs eligible for veterans' benefits, although they had been civilians and never enlisted in the armed forces. And at last, in 2010, 68 years after they had served their country, the remaining WASPs, fewer than 300 by then, were awarded a Congressional Gold Medal in an official ceremony in Washington, D.C. It was the first time that most people had heard of the civilian women pilots who had courageously served their country in World War II. Kate nearly stood up and cheered as she read about them with tears in her eyes, and wove what she had learned about the WASPs on the Internet into her story. Anne Wilder would have been just the kind of woman to sign up for the WASPs. It was perfect. Even the story of their uniforms was terrific. The uniforms they wore initially were used airplane mechanics' overalls, the smallest size being a men's 44 long. They were later required to buy tan slacks and white blouses for dress occasions. In 1943, a year after they started, the director of the WASPs, Jacqueline Cochran, had Bergdorf Goodman design a wool uniform in Air Force blue. The new outfit was approved by two Air Force generals, and it became the official WASP uniform. It had a skirt, a belted jacket, a white shirt, a black tie, the Air Force emblem, and the WASP emblem on the jacket, with a beret and black purse. At the same time, they were issued new flying uniforms, too, in the same Air Force Santiago blue with an Eisenhower jacket, slacks, a blue cotton shirt, and a black tie, with a baseball-style cap. Cochran had the clothes fitted by Neiman Marcus, and the WASPs were very proud of their new uniforms. They'd come a long way from used overalls in men's sizes. Kate went on writing the story for the Bible then. Anne is desperately worried about her husband and son in the war, and her mother is quieter than before, concerned about her grandson. She is less critical of Locke now, too. But generally, Hannibal is tough as nails. Anne and Maggie are running the business and are doing well. Locke and Bill are flying missions in the war as fighter pilots. A representative from the military comes to talk to Anne and asks if she will sign up for the WASPs to ferry planes for the military across the Atlantic without troops, which is a potentially dangerous mission. The WASP representative explains they are using women for these flights so they can spare the men for combat. She wouldn't be doing it all the time, just when they needed her. The WASPs are civilian volunteers and paid a small fee. She agrees to sign up as her contribution to the war effort. She will do it when she is needed and still be able to run her business. When Anne tells her mother, Hannibal begs her daughter not to do it and insists that she could be shot down by Germans flying over the Atlantic, but she's a good, steady pilot. Anne is determined, and finally Hannibal agrees to move in, to help her and stay with the kids when she is on missions. We see a softer side of Hannibal, who is terrified for her only daughter. Maggie wants to volunteer, too, but she isn't old enough, and Anne needs her at home. We see Anne flying ferrying missions with the WASPs and the other female pilots she meets. Anne and Maggie continue to run the business, which makes just enough to give them much-needed additional income. Anne has some close calls while ferrying, but she is never injured or shot down. Before the war ends, Locke's plane is shot down and he is killed. And not long after, just before the war ends, their son Bill is shot down and killed too. Anne receives her last letter from Locke, telling her how much he loves her after he is dead. Hannibal is now sympathetic and feels sorry for her daughter. As Kate wrote the words, tears poured down her cheeks. She stopped for a minute to catch her breath, and then wrote on, as the story flew out of her. As the war ends, Maggie is 22 and a terrific pilot. Anne is 44, Greg 20, and Crystal 19, and both of the younger ones are still trouble. The family is devastated over the loss of Locke and Bill. They have two flags and two gold stars in their window. Anne tries to figure out what to do now to support the family. Does she sell Locke's planes? Get a peacetime job? Continue trying to make ends meet with flying lessons and small charters? She comes up with an idea to use their larger, older planes to start an air freight business, and she and Maggie will fly the planes. They need Greg and Crystal to help in the office. And Hannibal stuns them all by telling them to put her to work, too. She's on board now and wants to do everything she can to help. She apologizes to Anne for her criticism of Locke and says she wanted her to have an easier life, but realizes now that he was a good man and how much they loved each other. Anne calls the freight business Wilder Express. They get a few small jobs at first and then bigger ones and charge handsomely for them. Every job is a victory for them as they carry cargo and are doing well. Hannibal is ornery with clients, but funny, and she works hard, and has her granddaughter Maggie give her flying lessons. Hannibal is feisty, ballsy, and tough, but also wonderful and speaks her mind. Anne is tireless and brave, and the business is holding its own. They're able to buy larger surplus planes now to carry larger cargo. They fly in tough weather conditions. Anne and Maggie have some close calls in bad weather, but always make it through. They hire a terrific young male pilot, Johnny West, when they can afford to. He's a great guy, helps them immensely, and he and Maggie fall in love. The younger two, Crystal and Greg, continue to have misadventures. There is resistance from other men in aviation to two women running an air freight business that is becoming noticeably successful. They deal with threats of sabotage to one of their planes, and Johnny, their young male pilot, is beaten up. The competition is nasty and rough, and tries to drive them out of the business, but Anne hangs on. And Hannibal is bold about confronting anyone she has to, and fearless, and maybe pulls a gun on one of them, some night when they're threatened. Hannibal, Anne, and Maggie are running the business, making money at it, and become profitable. They sell some of Locke's planes to buy better ones. It's a bittersweet moment for Anne when she parts with some of Locke's beloved planes to help the business. Hannibal tells Anne one night that Locke would be proud of her, and Anne tells Hannibal he would be proud of her, too. They trade some of Locke's old planes for more war surplus aircraft they can use, but save one or two of his very favorites. Anne constantly has to deal with Greg and Crystal's bad behavior while running the business, and Maggie and their young male pilot, Johnny West, have a strong romance. As time goes on, they have a very, very successful business, which becomes a real moneymaker. 5 years after the war, in 1950, it is a booming business they fought hard to build, and they still deal with constant prejudices against women. They hire more pilots, and maybe Hannibal flies a mission for them one night when they're short-handed. She's a decent pilot now, and a feisty old woman we come to love. She has mellowed a little. We see them running the business through the 1950s, fighting for women's rights and succeeding in a man's world. In time, it is one of the most successful air cargo companies in the country, hard-earned and hard-won. They hire more male pilots, some of whom they have to fire when they give them a hard time. Maybe they hire another female pilot. They hire a war hero pilot who knew Locke and applies for the job. He and Anne spar but respect each other. They have some battles and eventually fall in love. He is the first man in Anne's life since Locke died. It's 1953 to 1955. Their relationship is heated and passionate from the first. The business is run by three generations of strong women, Hannibal, Anne, and Maggie. Kate sat at her computer, thinking about what she'd written, and was stunned by the story that had suddenly come to her. It was midnight, and she had been writing for 15 hours. She called it The Wilder Women. It was the story of a family of women who had built an exciting business in a male-dominated industry and world. After she read it, Kate pulled out Zach Winter's card and sent him an email to tell him she'd written a story and wondered if he'd like to see it. He responded 2 hours later that he would, and told her to email it to him. She hit the send button, and then wondered what she had done. What if he hated it? But even if he did, she knew she loved it. The Wilder Women had come to life for her. Kate was overwhelmed by pride and panic, and had no idea what Zach would think. The next day, when she woke up, the snowstorm had turned into a blizzard, and her office was closed. She read the story again and was excited by it, and she sat looking out at the snow and wondered what would happen next. But one thing she did know, she hadn't had as much fun in years as she did writing about the Wilder Women the day before. She dedicated it to her grandmother, and she knew in every fiber of her being that her grandmother would have been proud of her, too. Chapter 5 The blizzard took 2 days to clear, and when everyone went back to work, Kate said nothing about what she'd written, not even to Carmen. She was waiting to hear from Zach, and there was no word from him for 3 weeks. By then she had gone through various phases of embarrassment, certain that her story was terrible and he'd hated it, but was too polite to tell her. So much so that he didn't even respond to her. She was trying to forget she wrote it when he called her 3 weeks later. "I think my spending New Year's Eve with Sam and Jesse turned out to be fortuitous for both of us," was the first thing he said to her, and she didn't dare ask him what he meant, or if he liked what she had sent him. She could barely focus on his words and braced herself for the worst. "I'm sorry I didn't get back to you sooner, but I've been busy," he said, sounding rushed. "I'm coming to New York tomorrow for a meeting. Do you have time for a drink?" She assumed he wanted to tell her in person what was wrong with her story and why it wasn't suitable for a Bible for a show. "Of course," she said, still embarrassed to have bothered him with it. She had been so excited when she wrote it, but had had time to cool off and doubt herself in the 3 weeks since she'd sent it. She was mortified, yet it must have looked like an amateurish attempt to him. She thought that now, after reading it over several times. "Where should I meet you?" He suggested the plaza, and said he was staying there. 6 o'clock? He offered. "That's great." He told her which bar to meet him at, and she sat at her desk at the magazine, staring at the computer, bracing herself for bad news the next day and heavy criticism, despite his gracious opening when he called her. She couldn't imagine him liking the story she'd written. She was a nervous wreck that evening in anticipation of the meeting. It took 3 episodes of Downton Abbey to calm her down late at night, but all she could think of was her own story now, trying to guess what he was going to say about it. Surely nothing good. She wore a serious black suit to work the next day and looked like she was going to a funeral. She'd worn black stockings and high heels with it, and Carmen stared at her in surprise when she stopped in to see her that afternoon. "Did someone die?" she said half-seriously. Kate was pale and seemed distracted, and there was terror in her eyes. "I have a meeting after work." "It can't be a happy one, judging by the strained expression on Kate's face." "Probably not." Kate didn't elaborate, and then Carmen left, without prying into the nature of the meeting. She took a cab to the plaza after work, arrived 10 minutes early, was seated at a table, and felt panicked when she saw Zack walk in. She was surprised to see him in a suit, with a pale blue shirt and a tie. There was no trace of his trendy style on New Year's Eve. He looked like any New York businessman, which set the tone for their meeting as they shook hands. "Is everything all right? You look so serious," he said, as he sat down across from her at the table in the oak bar. "So do you." She smiled at him, and he could see that she was scared. They ordered drinks before he said anything. He asked for scotch, and she for a glass of wine she was too nervous to drink. Nothing in years had frightened her as much as this meeting. She was convinced he was about to tell her how bad her story was, and had probably decided to meet with her in person out of respect for his old friend Sam. "Did you hear what I said when I called you yesterday?" he asked her with a smirk. "I told you that our meeting was fortuitous. I get the feeling that you missed that word and didn't hear me." She looked like she was about to cry. "I thought you were just being polite," she said honestly, and he saw that her hand was shaking when she took a sip of her wine. "I'm not that polite in business." He smiled at her and wanted to put her out of her misery quickly. "You wrote a terrific story, Kate. It would make a fantastic Bible for a series. The female characters in it are wonderful, and you could go on for years with the subplots after the backstory. I didn't want to get back to you until I had something concrete to tell you, and I think I do. I took 2 meetings last week about it, and another one 2 days ago. I didn't want to get your hopes up, but I think you may be my new good luck charm. I went to the cable networks I thought were right for it, and one of the major networks that I wanted can really use a show like this. They just had a series fall apart on them, and they canceled it. They have a gaping hole in their programming for next fall. They want to go with this, Kate. The Wilder Women is just what they need. It's still a little rough around the edges, and it needs some work, but the right screenwriter can do it with you. They want us to develop it and get them a script as soon as we can. He beamed at her as he spoke, and Kate looked like she was in shock. "But I can't write a script. I don't know how," she said as she set her glass down and stared at him, trying to understand what she'd just heard. It was the last thing she'd expected to hear from him. "I don't expect you to write the script. We'll get a screenwriter for that. I already talked to the one I want. She's finishing a project right now, which is lucky, too. She's young, but she's very good. You have to trust me on this. I've worked with her before. I sent your story to her, and she wants to do it. She's already written 2 successful shows. The network canceled one of them because they had trouble with the star, not because of the writing. I think she could do a fantastic job for you on this." He was all business as he talked to Kate and had thought of everything. He was brilliant at this. "Okay, wait a minute. I'm trying to understand. A cable network wants the story, and you already have a screenwriter to write the script?" "Basically, yes. We have to see what the writer gives us, and if we're happy with it, and if the network is. But if we like it, we lock her in. If we get the right screenwriter, they want 13 shows initially and 9 more after that, if we get lucky." He was used to success, but Kate wasn't. This was all new to her. "Oh, my God," Kate said and closed her eyes, and then opened them and looked at him. "Are you telling me that they're going to turn my story into a series? Just like that? We have a few hurdles to get over first. We all have to like the script. We've got to find the right actors for it. That's crucial. Preferably some really strong female leads who can carry the show, and a director who's good with women's shows. The stars have to line up just right. If we can't get the script to work, or the right cast, we won't get the show on the air by October, which is what they need. But if everything falls into place, you could have a series on the air by next fall. And I have some ideas for a director, and someone I want to approach to play Anne Wilder. It's a long shot, but I'm going to give it all I've got. She's never done a series before, only feature films, but she'd be perfect for this if she falls in love with it. The screenwriter I have in mind can start working on it in 2 weeks. She wants to meet with you first." Kate was smiling by the time he finished. It all sounded tentative and precarious, but it was actually possible that the story she'd written on New Year's Day might wind up on the air. "We have to start shooting by the 1st of July, which doesn't give us much time. I have a lot of work to do, and you need an agent to get the contract and money side of it set up. I can recommend several to you." She didn't want to tell him she would have done it for free, just for the thrill of it.